Burns Healy, first by mail form.
All right. So the first fundamental form is a tool for studying properties of surfaces. So first I'm going to say, what is a surface? So a surface is something embedded in R3 that locally looks like the plane, or more specifically, an open subset of the plane. So you've got U, open subset of R2, mapping to a surface. I'll draw the sphere just for simplicity. Parameterized by sigma. So sigma is a map on two variables, I'll call them u and v, that define this portion of the plane. So this map is three space, so it needs three components. Okay. So, what can we say about our surface? So, we've got something embedded in R3. Let's consider a point on it, call it P. We can ask what the tangent space looks like at that point. So, obviously, in one dimension, if you have a curve, your tangent space is going to look like a line. It's going to be a one-dimensional tangent space. Okay? In three dimensions, your tangent space is going to be two-dimensional. It's going to look like a plane. So what do we need to study a plane? Well, we're going to need two linearly independent vectors that lie within the plane. So we can get those by considering the vectors sigma sub u, sigma sub v, where u and v are, sigma sub u and sigma sub v are the partial derivatives at the point P. So, tangent space at P, defined as that, is generated by so, that gives us motivation to study three things we're going to call E, F, and G. And we're going to define this as sigma sub U, sigma sub u dot product here, sigma sub v, which of course by the symmetry of the dot product is going to be the same as saying sigma sub v, sigma sub u. And you might have guessed it, g is going to be sigma sub v, sigma sub v. And this is generally represented as a symmetric matrix of this form. And it's not intuitively obvious why we represent it as a matrix right away, but most of its applications have to do with using it as an operator on vectors or in using its determinant. So what's the most obvious use for this that we have? Well, we can consider it as, I keep using this sphere. I'll use a torus to show that it's more general. We can use it to define a metric on our surface. So consider two points P and Q. And we want to look at some distance between them. So we're going to define a metric as follows. And the reason this doesn't look like your traditional metric in R3 space is because you're confined to the surface at any given point. So, yeah. Another use we can use the first fundamental form for is considering area. So let's put another one in there. And we want to look at the area of this, call it D, on the surface. So take the double integral over d of the following. Square root of eg minus f squared. And if you'll notice, this is the square root of the determinant of that matrix. So again, part of why we represent it as a matrix. So let's do an example. We said a surface was something in R3 that locally looks like R2. Well, what's the most obvious example we can think of like that? Just the plane in R3, right? So how do we parameterize the plane? We can look at sigma of u and v and take two perpendicular unit vectors. Call them A and B. Then we can create a parameterization for R2 as some vector z plus u times the A vector plus v times b vector. It's pretty easy to calculate in this instance, sigma sub u and sigma sub v. Sigma sub u is going to be A. Sigma sub v, b. And so what's our E, F, and G? Well, we said E will be this. And we wanted A to be a unit vector. So it's just going to be 1. F is going to be sigma u, sigma v, A dot product with B. We wanted them perpendicular, so this is 0. And G, similar logic, you're going to get 1 because B is also a unit. So then our first fundamental form is just the identity matrix. And our distance metric is going to be your usual distance metric for R2. So no surprises there, right? So let's think of the most obvious non-trivial example we can of a surface sitting inside R3, which I'm going to use the sphere. So with latitude and longitude coordinates, you can define the map sigma like this. Pretty straightforward. And again, defining sigma or computing sigma u minus sine u sine v cos u sine v 0 sigma sub v And it's just a matter form to compute, again, E, F, and G. And thankfully, it's not as messy as all this because the trigonometric identities tend to work themselves out. We get E is sine squared B, F is 0, and G is 1. So our first fundamental form looks like this. Okay. So I'm going to define a term geodesic, which simply put is the shortest path between two points on a surface. So we're going to want to use the distance metric as defined by the first fundamental form. So let's consider two types of geodesics on the sphere. We'll say one where you're going directly north-south. So if you're going directly north to south, I know it's probably not intuitively obvious how u and v are defined, what this means, but it means that we're going to be keeping u constant. So this angle, v, is going to be the only thing changing. So you're going from a point north, going directly south. So your u is constant. Therefore, your du is 0. And the metric just becomes ds squared is dv squared. So that makes a lot of sense, right? If you're going straight north to south, your quickest path is going to just be dependent on B. You're just going to go right down the globe. But the kind of counterintuitive analog to this is, what if we're going directly east to west? So let's say you want to go from Austin to Cairo or somewhere that's directly east of us. Well then, that means we're keeping our V constant. So our dV is zero. And the metric then becomes dS squared equals sine squared V du squared. So suddenly, even though we're keeping our V constant between point A and point B, we still have this term in the metric in the shortest distance that is dependent on B. So what does that mean? That means that our shortest path is actually not going to be going directly east-west, or west-east, either way. Our geodesic, in this case, if we're above the equator, is going to look more like this. So you're actually going to go in a sort of curved pattern, go north, continue going east, and then come back south. And the reasoning for that is that as you go north, as you get closer to the North Pole, or if you're in the southern hemisphere, closer to the South Pole, it becomes easier to go east. As in, every step you take or per unit distance, you're actually going further along the edge of the Earth than you would be otherwise. So if you were at the North Pole and you took a couple of steps off it, the North Pole's right there, and you wanted to walk around the Earth, it'd be relatively easy, right? But if you're at the equator, obviously much more difficult, take much more time. So that's why if you've ever been on a plane going across the Atlantic from Austin, say, you're going to probably go through the Northeast. If you wanted to view the sphere like this and put the equator here, so it's sort of a mapping that just wraps around the sphere, going directly north-south, your geodesic would look like that. But in general, it's going to be sinusoidal. It's going to look sort of like that, dependent on this sine squared V. So, what else can we ask to know about a surface? Well, we can ask about its curvature, which, intuitively speaking, is simply how close it approximates a plane at any given point. The more it looks like a plane, the flatter it is, the less curvature it has. So if you consider a curved surface that looks kind of like this, and I apologize, my 3D drawing is pretty poor, you're going to have much more curvature up here than you are, say, in these regions that are pretty closely approximating a plane. Another way of putting it as well is that take this point here, take its tangent space. The curvature is going to be related to how far off and how quickly the surface diverges from your tangent plane. And we're going to call this K for curvature. Now, the curvature was originally defined in terms of the first fundamental form and something that you may have already guessed at existing, the second fundamental form, which is defined as follows. So, let me make sure I don't mix this up because I tend to get it upside down. I could have sworn I wrote it somewhere. So typically when you're calculating curvature, you'll do something in the, using the second fundamental form as well as the first. And again, you've got the notion of a discriminant here. But Gauss came up with what he called theorema egregium, which is Latin, I assume, for remarkable theorem. And the reason he considered it remarkable was that he discovered that you could calculate curvature by simply the first fundamental form, by E, F, F, and G. That calculation is extremely messy, and the formulas are just absolutely terrible. So you'd never probably practically do it that way. But the theoretical result was important because it said that your curvature at any given point is independent of local isometries, i.e. that it just simply depended on this idea of tangent space and the partial derivatives. And we got a couple more minutes. One more thing that this is really good for is consider, again, a surface and a curve along that surface. Now, in R3 or R2, it's pretty easy to calculate the length of a curve, right? But it's a little more tricky on a surface because it's confined to that, and it's not as easy to calculate. So the way to calculate a curve on surface and I'm using the dot here to represent derivative with respect to time. And just got a couple more minutes. I wanted to talk real quickly about a surface of revolution. And that's when you have a profile curve in 3 space that is revolved around the z-axis. So you define two functions, f of u, which is this distance, and g of u. And you can construct your, and this kind of wraps around like this. And so that's a, you know, fine surface. And you've got a parameterization that looks like this. And if you impose some very simple restrictions on f and u, essentially saying that this profile curve here, if you demand that it be unit speed, as in parameterized by its arc length, then you can come up from this with e is 1, f is 0, and g is f squared, which makes it a very interesting kind of surface that I wish I had time to talk about, but I don't. That's it. Are you sure? How do I get this off?
Cool. Right. Oh, yeah, thanks. So my talk is on perfect numbers, and in particular the odd perfect numbers. And sort of what's so odd about what may or may not be odd perfect numbers. So let's define what a perfect number is first. I'm just going to write PN instead of writing perfect number a whole lot. Is a number which is equal to the sum of its proper positive divisors. I can't write, so anyway. The first one I'm going to think of is 6. Which is equal to 1 plus 2 plus 3. Second one is 28. 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus, I was about to write 11, but that is not true, 7 plus 14. So the first four were actually known to the ancient Greeks. So the next ones being 496 and 8,128. So in 1456, some unknown mathematician discovered the fifth perfect number. Show you how quickly, or like how far apart these things are. The fifth one is 33,550,336. In 1588, some Italian guy discovered the sixth and seventh, which I don't know how he did this, but he must have had an enormous amount of time on his hands, much more than I have or would ever want to spend calculating things. The sixth one is, I don't usually say numbers this big, 8,589,000,869,056. Just for fun, the seventh one is 137,438,000,000. Well, no, I cannot read. Sorry, 137,438,000,000. My English is not good either. 691,328. So in 1588, came up with those. So there's a connection between perfect numbers and Mersenne primes, which Euclid proves in the Elements. So this is Euclid. This is proposition 36 from book 9 of the Elements, which in notation is 2 to the p minus 1 times 2 to the p minus 1 is perfect if 2 to the p minus 1 is prime. Which Euclid couldn't say this. He said, if as many numbers as we please, beginning from a unit, be set out continuously in double proportion until the sum of all becomes prime, and if the sum multiplied into the last makes some number, the product will be perfect. This is a much simpler way of saying that. So it was proposed in like around 1000 CE that this is the form of all even perfect numbers, but Euclid actually, Euler proved this. So the Euclid-Euler theorem, or the Euclid-Euclid theorem, so you can collaborate even if your collaborator has been dead for 1,000 years. Is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between Mersenne primes. I really cannot write. And perfect numbers. That's pretty cool. So if you have a Mersenne prime, you get a perfect number, and vice versa. So,
does that say 2 to the p minus 1?
It does, doesn't it?
Oh, okay.
That's what I meant. Yeah. So 2 to the p minus 1 times, yeah. So no, the squares of Mersenne primes are not perfect. So, but as you can see, all of these are even. And so an open question is whether or not there are any odd perfect numbers. And if there are, they're pretty weird. If they do exist, they're strange. So one thing is that they're big. So I'm going to say if n is an odd perfect number. Next to this is going to be a list of a bunch of facts. N is greater than 10 to the 1500. So to give some reference, there's like estimated like 10 to the 80 atoms in the universe. It's 10 to the 1500. This is actually shown earlier this year by Oakman Rao. Actually, a lot of the results on these are just in the past like 10 years or so. Another little fact, N is not divisible by 105. useful. This is by Kuno in 1949. So then I don't have a reference for this or a citation. N is congruent to 1 mod 12, or N is congruent to 117 mod 468, or N is congruent to 81 mod 324. So again, we have some feel for the structure. I don't know how this is shown, but it's neat. Next couple of things were done by Euler. So, you know, that N is equal to Q to the alpha times P1, 2, E to the 1, P... N to E to the N, where Q and then all the P's are distinct primes. Q is congruent to alpha, it's congruent to 1 mod 4. So these are both due to Euler. Smallest prime factor of n is actually related to the number of distinct primes that it has. Is less than 2 to the n plus 8 over 3. Is done in the 50s. This next one is actually proven by Occam and Rao again earlier this year, that either Q to the alpha is greater than 10 to the 62, or one of the P, 2, E, J is greater than 10 to the 62 for some J. And then N is less than 2 to the 4 to the n plus 1. That was done by Nielsen in 2003. So again, a lot of recent results. We're actually in stark opposition to my last talk. This one's going to go under time. So I'm almost at the end of this. So I'm just going to read the rest of these and start writing. So N has at least 101 prime factors, at least 9 of which are distinct. And then that was also by Occam and Rao this year. If 3 is not a prime factor, then it has at least 12 distinct prime factors. That was done in 2007 by Nielsen, the same guy that proved this bottom result. The largest prime factor of N is greater than 10 to the 8. That was done in 2008 by Oto and Goto. So Japanese names are fun. The second largest prime factor is greater than 10 to the 4, and the third largest is greater than 100. That was proven in 2000. One little neat thing, kind of just owing to their form, is that so in base 2, and even perfect number is just going to be P1s followed by P minus 1 zeros. So 28 plus 2. So it's kind of cool. Yeah, that's kind of it. yeah. Question?
Do you personally believe that there's not a perfect number?
I can't really say. I have no idea. I hope so. But a lot of number theorists say that there's probably not, that if there is one, it's a miracle. Like Sylvester has some quote that, like, if an odd perfect number has escaped this massive web that we've laid out for it, then its existence would be nothing short of a miracle. I mean, what like really, really surprised me is how recent all of these results are. I haven't like read any of these papers, but it seems like people still care about them at least a bit. Yeah.
So that means that every perfect number
gives a Mersenne prime? Mersenne prime, and every Mersenne prime gives rise to
so
perfect number.
But what about like if there was an odd perfect number, then how would it get?
Well, sorry. Yeah. So that's the yeah.
Was
so
that for even perfect
yeah.
Numbers?
So sorry, I did not. I guess say okay. That clearly. Yeah. So that form that I gave is the form of every even perfect number.
Okay.
So we don't have a little nice closed form for odd perfect numbers, because that would
prove their existence. Well, I mean, my point was like the correspondence right. said perfect numbers, not even perfect numbers. That's why I was confused. That's fine. I was just confused. All right. I'm glad that I have the extra time that I do. Means that we can slow the pace down a little bit, which might be nice. We're going to see. We'll see. I'm going to write some things down. Obviously the background of people in this room varies pretty widely. So most of the things that I'm going to write down are intended to be more accessible to the lower range of backgrounds. And I'm going to say things out loud that are intended to make sense to people that have stronger backgrounds. So if I say things and they don't mean anything to you, don't worry about it. Keep following. You'll get good things out of this. You won't necessarily understand all of it, but you'll get good ideas. So the basic motivation that we're going to start with is so we have this thing called Galois theory. Galois theory tells us that if we have finite extensions of the rational numbers, so we can talk about, Q adjoin some element alpha where, alpha is a root of some polynomial, P of X with, rational coefficients. Okay, for those of you who had linear algebra, it's a finite dimensional vector space over Q. But it has a nicer structure. It forms a field, so it forms something where we can add, subtract, multiply, and divide by anything that's not zero. And Galois theory studies for specific types of extensions like this. So like we write these kinds of extensions like K. What I'm going to call Galois extensions, whatever that means, we can talk about the Galois group of K over Q, which is just the automorphisms of K that fix Q, and the Galois extensions are nicer. So the easiest kind of extensions we can deal with in Galois theory are cyclotomic extensions. So this is Q adjoin zeta P over Q, or in general zeta N. So this is adjoining the primitive nth roots of unity. And, it turns out that this degree, which is the dimension as a vector space, is equal to phi of n, or this is the Euler-Totient function. So it's, the number of integers less than n that are relatively prime to n. And even more so, for the people with a little more background maybe, is canonically isomorphic to this in some way. So in particular, we want to look at gal of Q zeta P for an odd prime P, because adjoining the primitive second roots of unity doesn't actually do anything. So this is isomorphic to Z mod P Z star. But this is different from this in general, in that this is, itself has a very nice structure in that it's, cyclic. So there's this theorem of Galois theory that says there's a bijection between subgroups of this and fields that are contained between the two. And so in particular, this is a cyclic group. For those of you who've had basic group theory, you know that for a cyclic group, there is a unique subgroup of any index dividing the order. And so this has a unique subgroup of index 2 and a unique subgroup of index. So I'm going to call this thing H. Okay? And if we talk about the fixed field, so we write this as this. This is going to be, the degree over Q is going to be the same degree as the index. So this is going to be some quadratic field, which quadratic fields look like this for some square free integer D. And those of you who have had, like, even, you know, first semester course in algebra, you know enough to be able to prove this. This is a pretty good thing. So what this tells us is that Q adjoin zeta P has a unique quadratic subfield that's contained within it. So we want to understand what this thing is, because Galois theory tells us that it exists, but it doesn't tell us what it is, you know, concretely. So I have this magical quadratic field here. Anybody want to take a guess at what it is? Basically, you're guessing what D is here. What? I heard somebody over here.
Negative 1.
Negative 1? Okay, so we got guess for D equals negative 1. Any other guesses? Yeah, so those are the other two. So, well, unfortunately, negative one's not going to work out, I can tell you that. These, well, it's going to be each of them exactly half of the time, but we'll get to that. So, you know, the idea is we don't have the machinery to solve this problem with just basic abstract algebra. So we're going to turn to algebraic number theory. So, we get this very nice object inside of a field, a number field, finite extension of Q. So in general, I'm going to say an element, this is a definition here, an element alpha is integral over a ring R if alpha is a root of a monic polynomial in Rx. So this just means a polynomial with coefficients in your ring. For those of you who haven't had algebra, just think of this is integer. Integers has integer coefficients. And for those of you with a little more background, this is equivalent to, inseparable issues, whatever, is equivalent to this being finitely generated. But that's not important. So the point of it is I'm going to define this new ring that I'm going to call OK, which is the set of all alpha and K such that alpha is integral over Z. And this is a strange thing, like, when you first see it. I mean, why should this have any particular nice structure? Why does this even form a ring? And the way it forms a ring is actually the thing that I just erased, was algebra stuff. But, you know, we can still, you know, look at nice properties of this. So, for example, and I'll talk a little more about this later, if we take Q join I, so this is set of all A plus BI, A and B are rational, then in this case, OK is just ZI. So this is A plus BI, where A and B are in Z. In general, we don't get a form, so, you know, quite as nice as this. But we'll see that too. The point is in this case, you know, we still have niceness. This looks similar to something we're comfortable with. We have unique factorization in this, just like we have in the integers. In general, these things aren't going to have unique factorization, but what it does have is unique factorization of ideals. So in this case, it means that any ideal, so we can write I uniquely as I'm not going to call these E for possible confusion later. We can, you know, write these things as a write these things as uniquely as a product of prime ideals. And let's see, what more do I want to say about this? For those of you, again, with a little more background, OK is actually isomorphic to Z raised to some power as Z modules, which basically means that this thing is almost like a vector space. It's like a vector space where our coefficients are in Z. You can't, you know, it's not quite as nice as a vector space, because in a vector space you can scale by any amount and that kind of thing, where in Z you can't. But it does give us a nice thing in that it has a basis. So you can talk about an integral basis. Is just a Z basis. So this is a set, you know, omega 1 through omega n, where any element like alpha and OK can be expressed uniquely as, you know, some ci times omega I with your ci and z. So for those of you who've had linear algebra, that kind of thing looks familiar. You know, if you have a basis, any vector can be expressed uniquely in that way. So now we can define the norm of some element is just the product where the sigmas are in the Galois group. Of the Galois closure. Don't worry about what that means if you don't know. And then the trace is just the sum of these things. Don't worry about what these mean. Just on their own, they're not too meaningful. But they do allow us to define, so we can talk about the discriminant. And the discriminant of a number field, K over Q, is so it's just it's notated like this. I mean, I'm going to basically drop the over Q part. And say that it's just the determinant of the trace applied to omega I times omega j. And this, like, you're taking these over all I and j, so you get a matrix. And then you take the determinant of that matrix. And that's, I mean, that's a nasty thing. Like, not only do I have to find this integral basis, but then I have to, like, take the trace of all these things, put it into a matrix, and then take the determinant. That's terrible. So, in the special case, when... So when an integral basis looks like 1 alpha, alpha to, I mean, this is the degree, minus 1, then the discriminant is plus or minus, and I'm not going to worry about the sign because for what I'm going to talk about, it's not important at all. Is plus or minus the product of I less than J of sigma I alpha minus sigma J alpha. And this product goes across, again, all the Galois conjugates. So we have, you know, and by my definition, it's not obvious that this is a uniquely determined thing, but it turns out that it is. So we have at least an invariant that we can somehow distinguish fields by. So, you know, this seems to be getting towards what I want to get to. Not quite enough, but, you know, whatever. We can talk about that. So, next important thing to talk about is these primes. So if you take a prime, so what are the prime ideals of Z? I don't know, had anybody have at first semester algebra? Prime ideals of Z? Yes. So these are just, you know, for people that haven't had algebra, it's just the set of multiples of P. So the primes of Z. And so we want to take this, and we're going to lift these primes to our ring of integers by sending P to P times OK, which is, I mean, you're multiplying ideals. But, I mean, just think about this is the principal ideal generated by P. And so I said that we had unique factorization. And so P, you know, P OK can be written as, you know, product of PI to the EI for some prime ideals PI, you know, raised to some powers maybe, whatever. And we say prime P ramifies if some EI is greater than 1. So if we get some power, you know, some prime ideal that occurs with multiplicity bigger than 1, we say that P splits completely if, say this goes from I equals 1 to R. Splits completely if R equals the degree and EI equals 1. I mean, I'll explain that a little more. And then P is inert if P OK is prime. And it turns out you can also talk about, so with prime ideals, you can quotient by prime ideals, and you get integral domains. In this case, you actually get the prime ideals are also maximal, the non-zero ones. And so you get that's an extension of the original field. So, like, what I'm trying to say is that OK mod some PI is an extension of Z mod P. And if you define this degree to be fi, then you get that the sum of ei, fi equals n. Yeah, not doing too bad. All right. And in the special case, when K is Galois, so I kind of skipped the definition of Galois on purpose earlier. But in, you know, when you have, think of Galois just being like the nicest possible extensions you can have. Well, almost nicest. There's one more step that we'll see later. But nice primes, then the Galois group acts transitively on the primes above P. And the primes above P, what I mean by that, are just the primes that show up in this factorization. Okay? And so as this, you know, from this, we get as a corollary that if K is Galois, then EI equals EJ, and FI equals FJ for all IJ. You know, for those of you with a little more background, think about why that's true. Just automorphisms have to preserve everything. But, you know, now I'm adding even more things that are even more intractable to deal with. So, you know, a big thing in algebraic number theory is, you know, basic algebraic number theory is, when do these things happen? You know, when does it ramify? When does it split completely? When is it inert? When is it something in between? That kind of thing. So, we do have a nice characterization. So, it turns out P ramifies if and only if P divides the discriminant. Which is, I mean, surprising. I mean, that's a immediate thing you can say without doing too much. But, you know, we want to take this now, we've developed a little bit of basic algebraic number theory, and try to answer our original question. So, if we look at the case of quadratic fields, then, so in this case, you know, K is Q adjoined square root of D, and we have that OK is Z adjoined square root of D, or Z adjoined 1 plus the square root of D over 2. This is if D is congruent to 2 or 3 mod 4. And this is if D is congruent to 1 mod 4. And we exclude the case where D is congruent to 0 mod 4, because that means D is not square free. You know, it's divisible by 2 squared. And from this, you can get that the discriminant is 4D or D, depending on if D is 2 or 3 mod 4, and if D is congruent to 1 mod 4. But that's still, like, what does this tell us? That doesn't tell us anything, you know, in relation to the cyclotomic fields. But we can also talk about splitting behavior. And, you know, in quadratic fields, there's only three possibilities for the splitting behavior because of this. And that is P is either ramified, and so it's either, you know, some prime squared, or it splits completely, splits into two primes, or it's inert, and then the residue extension is actually, you know, non-trivial. But so we have for odd primes P, because 2 is strange and everything has to be, P splits if and only if this is the Legendre symbol, which means that it splits if D is a square mod P, and it's inert if D is a non-square. And that'll come up a little bit later, but we'll see. I lost my eraser. So now we have enough to talk about, you know, what is the subfield? So the discriminant of Q, zeta n, is some horrible formula. Negative 1 to the phi of n over 2 times n raised to the phi of n over the product of p dividing n times dividing n, p to the phi of n over p minus 1. That's nasty, and it's equally nasty to prove. But in our case, we have the discriminant of Q zeta p is, you know, plugging this stuff in, p to the p minus 2. So what primes ramify here? Anybody? What primes divide this? Yeah, so p is the only prime. Okay, and because p is the only prime ramified, you know, if anything ramifies in a smaller subfield, then it has to ramify in the bigger thing, because you just take that, you know, that thing that's ramified and it splits even more, and then those things are, never mind. Think about it. So using this, we know that this thing, for whatever that quadratic subfield is, has to be divisible only by p. So what is it? No? Okay, fine. So we have two cases. So p is congruent to 1 mod 4. And p is congruent to 3 mod 4. What I call that field. So Q zeta P H, same thing. Anybody? Come on. Liven up. No? Okay. Alright, well then I guess I'll just tell you. It's P and it's minus P. Well, I guess it's Q adjoin square root of P and Q adjoin square root of minus P. Or, in other words, if I write p star equals p times negative 1 to the p minus 1 over 2, then it's q adjoin the square root of p star always. So, we've answered our original motivating question, but can we do something more concrete? Can we do something maybe like we can prove quadratic reciprocity, which is, you know, seemingly totally unrelated to something like this? So I'm going to abbreviate quadratic reciprocity like this. We have, if P and L are distinct odd primes, then I know some of you have had number theory. Anybody remember this? No. My audience is dead. I'm just not even going to bother asking now. All right, then we have this, which is, you know, p is a square mod L times, you know, L is a square mod p is equal to this, you know, whatever. That's what quadratic reciprocity says. But now we got to relate it back to what we're doing. So let over Q be finite Galois. Then I said, you know, Gal K over Q acts transitively on the primes above any prime. So, again, we're going to write POK as the product of, you know, PI. Now I'm just going to write E. I don't have to write EI because it's Galois. These are all equal. And I'm going to write, you know, D sub PI is going to be the subgroup of the Galois group such that PI is fixed. It's called the decomposition group of PI. And because Gal acts transitively, any two decomposition groups are conjugate. And so you want to look at, you know, when can we actually say that these are all the same? Because, I mean, that's a kind of a natural thing. And that's, if the Galois group is abelian, that's definitely going to happen because conjugation is trivial when you're abelian. So you can actually say if and, you know, and you can also say a little bit more. So, if P is unramified, then this decomposition group, which now, I mean, now I can just really, I'm going to write it almost like that because I told you it's independent of which prime I'm talking about. Then this is isomorphic to, I mean, for this point, I'm going to do this, but is isomorphic to the Galois group of, well, of OK mod PI over Z mod P. So this is just a finite field extension, right? So this is cyclic. This is generated by Frobenius. You know, X maps to X to the P. And so, you know, if we call this automorphism phi, then define, you know, Frobenius of P to be, you know, the inverse image of Frobenius. And denote Frobenius of P by P K over Q. And then because, you know, we have unique factorization, you can extend this multiplicatively to any ideals who are not divisible by ramified primes. Is anybody following this at this point? Cool, I got one thumbs up. So we have, I told you before that Gal of Q zeta P over Q is canonically isomorphic to Z mod P Z star. And down here we have the Galois group of Q adjoined square root of P star over Q. This is quadratic, so it's, you know, isomorphic to Z mod 2Z, but that's just plus or minus 1. So I'm going to call these maps. This is going to be phi, phi bar, psi bar, psi. Whoa, no bar. And this contains, so now let L be distinct odd prime from P. So, you know, any other odd prime. And so, you know, L is unramified in this extension because remember, only P ramifies in here. And so, I'm going to, for simplicity purposes, I'm going to call this K because I don't want to keep writing Q zeta P. So K over Q is in here. And, I mean, these are subjective maps, I should say. I mean, that follows from Galois theory. And this actually is going to map down to, under this restriction, to L of Q P star over Q. Okay. Over here, any automorphism is going to look like, you know, zeta P maps to zeta P to the A for some A. And then under this map, I'm going to say that this is going to map to A, you know, mod P. And then this, there's a unique map, and that is, it's you know, the map I described earlier, which is the Legendre symbol. So, the point is that this is commutative. So, if we take L here, and we go this way, we get L mod P. When you drop it down, you get, you know, so going this way, so psi bar of phi applied to L, well, applied to L, I called it K over Q. And this is just L P. And if I go this other direction, so if I restrict this down, what is this going to be in here? Well, think about the fact that this is an isomorphism, and this is the Frobenius element. So, let's see. I did erase it. Okay. So, if L splits in here, there's going to be two primes, and that means that the residue extensions are going to be trivial, and that means the Frobenius element is going to be trivial, which means that when you lift it backwards under an isomorphism, it's still going to be trivial, which means that it's going to map to 1. So here, this, so L Q zeta P, or square root of P star over Q maps to 1 if L splits. And if it doesn't split, then it's inert, because I said it was unramified. And if it's inert, then the Galois group of the residue extension is going to be non-trivial. And then your Frobenius element is going to be non-trivial, so you're going to pull it back, and have to get something non-trivial. So you have to get that it maps to -1 if P is inert. But what did I tell you about the behavior of primes in quadratic fields? Well, I told you L splits. This splits if and only if P star over L equals 1, and this is if and only if P star over L equals -1, which means that L actually just maps to, you know, it actually maps to just this sign. So what we're getting from that is that phi bar of psi applied to this element is just P star over L. So, L over P equals P star over L. So that says that if I multiply each side by P over L, so I have L over P, P over L. Now this is what showed up in quadratic reciprocity, right? So I should somehow get this. But this is P star over L times P over L. But the Legendre symbol is multiplicative. So this is, remember that P star is -1 to the P minus 1 over 2 times P. So this is -1 to the P minus 1 over 2 times P squared over L, which equals -1 to the P minus 1 over 2 over L times P squared over L. P squared is obviously a square mod L, and it's square of P, so that's 1. So that's this, but remember I defined the Legendre symbol to be, I raise this thing to the L minus 1 over 2. So I get that this is equal to -1 to the P minus 1 over 2 times L minus 1 over 2, which is exactly what, this says. And that's it.